KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump's tariffs hit goods from around the world. So we bring you reactions from the markets across Asia and Europe to the auto industry in Lansing, Michigan. That's coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump wants someone else to take over TikTok from its Chinese owners by Saturday. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. YouTuber Mr. Beast wants it, but the company Oracle looks like the front runner. Would a deal sever TikTok from China? Also, ICE is adding immigration warrants to a database used by local police, but courts haven't settled on exactly how cops should handle those situations. And is Elon Musk becoming a liability for Republicans? It's Thursday, April 3rd. On this day in 1973, the first portable phone was demonstrated for reporters. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Stocks opened sharply lower this morning as investors react to President Trump's sweeping tariff announcement. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 1,300 points in early trading.
The size and scope of the new tariffs caught many investors by surprise. Stock markets around the world sank, a flashing red warning sign of the economic fallout that's expected to result from the president's widening trade war. Starting this weekend, the U.S. will impose a minimum 10% tariff on nearly all imports, with much higher levies to follow next week on goods from dozens of countries around the world. The import taxes amount to a nearly nine-fold increase in tariffs the U.S. had been charging last year. Much of that cost will be borne by U.S. businesses and consumers. The tariffs are expected to lead to higher prices and slower economic growth. Factories and farmers could also suffer as global trading partners retaliate with tariffs of their own on U.S. exports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Automaker Stellantis says because of Trump's new tariffs on imports of foreign autos, it will pause production at plants in Canada and Mexico for about 2 weeks. But news reports say Stellantis will also trigger temporary layoffs of about 900 auto workers at U.S. plants in Michigan and Illinois. Writing online, President Trump appears enthusiastic about the tariffs. So is Vice President Vance.
We're going to cut taxes for American workers and for American companies that build here. We're going to make it harder to ship American jobs overseas. It's a total shift in the way that we've done economic policy in the United States of America, but it was necessary. So, yeah, we're going to cut your taxes. You're going to have more money in your pocket, and that's, of course, going to help you deal with the cost of inflation.
Vance spoke to Fox News this morning. Israel is expanding its war in Gaza. It has now ordered hundreds of thousands of people to evacuate areas from the north to the south of the enclave. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports Gaza's health ministry says since Israel broke the ceasefire last month, more than 1,100 Palestinians have been killed and more than a third of them are children.
Israel's military has ordered people across northern Gaza, the entire southern area of Rafah, and now eastern Gaza City to flee. The evacuation orders issued online tell people to move to designated shelters, but aid groups say schools that have been bombed in the war are already full with displaced people, and they're running out of tents to distribute because of a month-long blockade imposed by Israel. UN staff in Gaza have seen civilians shot trying to flee Rafah in recent days. 15 paramedics and rescue workers were killed by Israeli soldiers trying to rescue people in Rafah. The military says it was firing on militants. Israel says it's seizing large areas of Gaza to expand a buffer zone. It's also working to facilitate the removal of Palestinians from the territory altogether. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down well over 1,400 points. The Nasdaq is off nearly 5%. It's NPR. At least three people have been killed in tornadoes and other severe storms, one person in Missouri and two more in Tennessee. The National Weather Service says a multi-day series of storms are now underway. These are expected to produce catastrophic flash flooding from eastern Oklahoma and Arkansas to the Ohio Valley. There have been numerous tornadoes sighted in the region. The CEO of aircraft maker Boeing is acknowledging the company made serious missteps that hurt the quality and safety of its aircraft. But as David Shaper reports, he's promising key lawmakers Boeing is improving its safety protocols and culture.
Under questioning from members of the Senate Commerce Committee, Boeing CEO Kelly Ortberg admits production flaws and lax oversight led to a door plug blowing out of an Alaska Airlines 737 in flight in January of last year.
Boeing made serious missteps in recent years, and it's unacceptable. In response, we've made sweeping changes to the people, processes, and overall structure of our company.
Changes that Ortberg says will improve the quality and safety of Boeing planes. But family members of those killed in two Boeing 737 MAX crashes want the company held accountable for its design and production flaws and for deceiving safety regulators. For NPR News, I'm David Shaper.
Embattled New York City Mayor Eric Adams says he will withdraw from the upcoming Democratic primary. He plans to run for re-election as an independent candidate. A federal judge this week upheld a Justice Department decision not to prosecute Adams for alleged corruption. Again, on Wall Street, the Dow was down 1,400 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The new tariffs from President Trump will hit goods from around the world. At least 10% taxes on nearly everything the U.S. imports. They go much higher for dozens of countries, including 34% on products from China and 24% from Japan. In a few minutes, we'll have reaction from Lansing, Michigan, where car manufacturing is a major part of the economy. But first, the global reaction.
Yeah, leaders across the world have reacted with dismay and confusion following President Trump's announcement. Some are preparing countermeasures targeting the U.S., while others are hoping to strike up negotiations.
For more on this, we turn to Beijing now with NPR's John Ruich. John, good morning.
Good morning.
So U.S. stock futures fell overnight after the announcement, but how have global markets taken the news?
Well, the fallout in markets has been far and wide. You know, some of the countries that are hardest hit by the tariffs and actually that are most dependent on trade with the U.S. are in Asia. And we saw a broad sell-off here from Hong Kong and China to South Korea, all the way down to Southeast Asia. Markets were down. Trump put a 24% tariff on Japanese goods, which apparently surprised markets there. The Nikkei 225 dropped close to 3% today. In Vietnam, which has been a huge beneficiary of U.S.-China trade friction as manufacturers have moved south of the border, Trump hit it with one of the highest tariff rates, 46%, and the country's Ho Chi Minh stock index shed nearly 7% on the day. In Europe, it seems to be a similar story of selling. You know, economists are recalibrating their expectations now, and investors are just nervous.
And what about governments? How are governments around the world reacting?
Unhappiness and frustration so far. I mean, many say these tariffs were unwarranted. Here's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese of Australia, which got the bare minimum 10%.
The administration's tariffs have no basis in logic, and they go against the basis of our two nations' partnership. This is not the act of a friend.
Britain was hit with the minimum 10% also, but the Prime Minister's office there expressed some relief that the country wasn't hit with 20% like the EU. Speaking of which, the European Commission president said Europe was open to negotiations, but working on countermeasures in case the talks fail. You know, President Trump has signaled that he's open to deal making, so many countries are taking these sweeping tariffs as kind of an opening salvo for negotiations. Others are looking at a range of options. You know, Japan, Brazil, China have suggested that tariffs break World Trade Organization rules.
What about in China, where you are? What's been the reaction there?
Well, the Commerce Ministry issued a statement calling for the removal of these tariffs, and it says they are, you know, protectionism leads nowhere. China's been hammered by tariffs before and was frankly girding for this moment. The across-the-board tariff rate on Chinese imports to the U.S. now is about 54%. Trump was talking about 60% while he was campaigning, so it's not far off from that. Professor Wu Xinbo of Fudan University in Shanghai thinks China will retaliate once the Trump tariffs take effect in a few days. And then hopefully at some point the two sides can talk.
If neither side don't want to get locked down in a lose-lose situation, we have to find a way out.
But he thinks China can afford to punch back and then wait for a bit to see if Trump administration feels some heat from all these tariffs.
Any sense of how damaging these tariffs will be to these countries?
Yeah, I asked Jack Zhang about this. He's a professor at the University of Kansas, and he runs the trade war lab there. He says it kind of all depends.
I still hold out a sliver of hope because it depends on how much trade destruction happens, and that depends on how much retaliation we're going to see.
You know, a lot of economists think these tariffs are going to be a big global shock anyway, and could push, you know, many countries into recession.
That is NPR's John Roach in Beijing. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Back here in the U.S., the Conference of Mayors is urging President Trump to reverse course on these tariffs. In a statement Wednesday, they called for trade policy that, quote, protects businesses, workers, and families. For The View from Lansing, Michigan, we've got Mayor Andy Shore on the line with us. Good morning, Mayor. Thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. I appreciate the chance to be on.
So you are one of the mayors calling on President Trump to reverse course, and Lansing was already feeling the impact of the tariffs placed on Canada. Now there are these new tariffs. Your city has two GM assembly plants. I mean, what will this mean for your residents?
But my biggest concern, especially when it comes to the auto plants and cars and auto manufacturing in general, is that prices are going to go up. You know, we do a lot of cross-border work. You know, we send parts across and then parts come back, and we make the cars here. But if cars go up, you know, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a car, then people are going to buy less cars. If people buy less cars, then that threatens any of our auto plants. If the auto plants aren't selling the cars that they make and they're not making more cars, it threatens shifts. There could be reduction in shifts. There could be, you know, the worst scenario is a closure of a plant, and all of that would be tragic, terrible for our economy. You know, years ago we fought to make sure that plants don't close, and we've got two of them here. One of them, Lansing Grand River, we're ending the Camaro. GM is ending the Camaro, and we want to make sure there's new product. But if people aren't buying cars, then we're not making them, and if we're not making them, that's going to, you know, it's going to force layoffs and less shifts and affect our workers and our economy. So that's a huge concern, especially when our residents make average of $48,000 a year. They can't afford $10,000 more for a new car.
I mean, what we've heard from this administration, well, tariffs will be higher on cars made abroad, and that will give American-made cars an edge. What do you say to that argument?
But I think that assumes that everything that's done elsewhere is going to be reshored into America. And certainly I'd love to see that, but the hurt is going to be huge. You know, if it's billions of dollars to create a new auto plant or to build new manufacturing, we'd love to see it. But to be honest with you, it doesn't guarantee it's going to happen. It just guarantees that prices are going to go up. So if prices are going to go up and we're not going to see, you know, new jobs as a result, especially not anytime soon, it's just going to have negative impacts. You know, we want in Lansing and all across, especially the North, you know, we want free and fair trade. We want to make sure that it's fair, that's fair going both ways. But what was done is going to be is going to hurt our residents from auto to groceries to steel. You know, we're on the razor's edge when it comes to building, and we've got a lot of development coming. And if costs go up for steel or for wood, that could impact and reduce development, at which impacts and reduces jobs. So I'm concerned about all of that.
Well, these tariffs are now a reality. So how are you preparing as mayor for the economic impact that you said you're concerned about? I mean, what will your city do?
We're trying to do as much as we can here. We work with, again, developers and others. We're pushing the federal government to retain some of the grants that were given to us. We were given a grant, GM was given a grant of $500 million to convert one of our plants to EV or PEV, the hybrid cars. We need to make sure those are still going to come so GM can convert. You know, we're going to continue to make cars. We just have to figure out what's the cost going to be when auto parts go up. You know, we do a lot of our own advanced manufacturing here. We've got a food testing company called Neogen that does food testing. So we're doing everything we can to incent doing more advanced manufacturing here. But it's only so much we can do when the federal government cuts your legs out from underneath you with trade.
Lansing Mayor Andy Shore, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The federal government has added hundreds of thousands of immigration arrest warrants to a national database used by local police. As NPR's Martin Costi reports, that means local cops are now more likely to know if someone is wanted by ICE.
If you're ever pulled over for, say, speeding, the National Crime Information Center is what the cop will use to run your name. NCIC flags criminal warrants from other states or from the feds, and it also includes warrants for immigration charges. But under President Trump, there's a lot more of those. The administration recently put at least 500,000 more immigration cases into NCIC. And Terry Cunningham of the International Association of Chiefs of Police worries about how that's going to play out.
There's going to be so many of these in NCIC, and some street cops going to, you know, roll in behind the 7-Eleven at 2 o'clock in the morning and run somebody and get a hit on a detainer. And it's going to be a civil detainer, not a criminal warrant.
Detainers are ICE requests that police hold someone until ICE can come and take that person into custody. But the thing about detainers is that they tend to be civil warrants, not signed by a judge.
There's been no adjudication, which gets really sticky.
Counties have been sued for millions of dollars for arresting someone based only on this kind of ICE detainer. And now that the NCIC system has so many more of them, Cunningham sees greater legal risk. ICE would not directly confirm to NPR that it has increased the number of immigration detainers in NCIC. It says it won't comment on internal methods because of, quote, operational security. But it also says adding those arrest warrants to NCIC is routine and a, quote, vital tool to protect public safety. Local cops say they have seen the change on their computers.
These warrants are now showing up in our database.
Douglas Griffith is president of the Houston Police Officers Union. The department tells officers not to inquire about a person's immigration status, but if the computer flags someone, it says they should call ICE. Griffith says it's clear to him what the next step should be.
If they pop up with a warrant, and we have no alternative but to take those people into custody.
But legal experts say it's not that black and white, especially if ICE is slow in arriving to pick that person up. Once the officer has written the speeding ticket, for instance, how long is it okay to hold the person in custody there by the roadside waiting for ICE? Half an hour? An hour? Cunningham says the courts haven't settled what's reasonable, and his organization has just updated its advice to police departments for how to navigate the legalities of all this. But he recognizes that politics also plays a role.
You've got states now that have said, we want our officers not to be involved in any immigration enforcement issues at all. Then you get other states that are mandating that, you know, officers get involved.
And he says it's the patrol officer, the one who sees that ICE detainer popping up on the screen, who ends up caught in the middle. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Bury me where the wind don't
On the next Fresh Air, songwriter, singer, and guitarist Jason Isbell, who is described in Variety as the Poet Laureate of American Rock. He won 9 Americana Music Awards and 6 Grammys. His new solo album includes songs about the breakup of his marriage to singer-songwriter and violinist Amanda Shires. Join us.
See the windmills turn up 55.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Elon Musk, the billionaire who's President Trump's biggest donor, will remain an advisor to the administration even after he leaves his Doge cost-cutting effort. That's according to Vice President J.D. Vance this morning. Musk's mandate as a special government employee expires around late May. Here's Vance on Fox News.
Doge has got a lot of work to do. And yeah, that work's going to continue after Elon leaves. But fundamentally, Elon is going to remain a friend and an advisor of both me and the president, and he's done a lot of good things.
But recent polls show the public's view of Musk is getting more negative. Musk made big donations and campaigned heavily in support of the conservative candidate in this week's Wisconsin Supreme Court race. Those efforts did not pan out. For more on how Musk's participation in GOP politics is playing, we have Jonathan Martin. He is the senior political columnist at Politico, and in case you're wondering, no relation, so far as we know. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. Good morning.
So there were a number of issues at play in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, abortion, redistricting. How big of a factor do you think was Elon Musk's participation in that race? He made big donations, some really attention-getting moves, like giving really large checks to people who signed petitions supporting an initiative that he cared about. So how big of a factor was he?
I think he was a central player in this campaign in ways that helped the Republicans in some ways, but I think really were more harm than good, Michelle, and this is why. He made himself the face of the campaign. It's one thing to contribute. It's one to contribute a lot of money to help your candidate, but he was the principal surrogate in a rally on Sunday in Green Bay. He put the famous Packers cheesehead, an indelible image on, and I think perhaps most significant, he brought those oversized checks to hand out money to Wisconsin voters. And I just think that really backfired on the Republican-aligned nominee, because that's just not a good state. Wisconsin, this is upper Midwest, you know, highly engaged, you know, very civically minded voters. You don't go there and show up with cash to pay Wisconsin folks for their votes. I think it just backfired on Musk. He made it about himself. And I think that explains, if not the loss, certainly the margin of the loss. Nobody thought it'd be a 10-point race.
So that's, Musk is also the face of the government spending cuts with this group, the Department of Government Efficiency. It's not a department, have to say that again, called Doge. He's a special government employee, meaning he always had a 130-day time limit on his employment with the federal government. A month ago, Politico reported that advisors were saying the White House might find a way to extend that limit, but yesterday, Politico reported that Trump is now quietly telling aides that Musk may be leaving soon. Why is that, and what do you think's changed?
Well, I think that the politics have changed. He is more unpopular than Trump himself, especially with independents and Republicans. They're both kind of despised among Democrats these days. And so he's become more of an anchor. And he has really irritated, I think, White House staffers and congressional Republicans for the same reason, because he's somebody who just offers Democrats one more reason to get fired up. You know, we all lived through 2017, 2018, that first kind of backlash to Trump in the first term. Well, this is so similar, but you have the added figure of Elon Musk, who I think just turbocharges the backlash to Trump. And they just don't need any more. It's enough to give Democrats the kind of backlash they have with Trump. Why add to that with Elon Musk?
Could it work the other way, though, that in a way he kind of detracts, he sort of takes the, he's like a lightning rod, right? He's the lightning rod and it goes to him. The negativity goes toward him.
Yeah, I've heard the heat shield theory that he takes the heat from Trump. I just don't think Trump buys that because, A, he takes attention from Trump, and, B, he's deeply unpopular. And I think that for Trump, that's a lose-lose. He doesn't like people who – yeah.
So 30 seconds left. If Musk does leave the White House per se, could he be an asset to Republicans outside the White House?
By doing what he should have done in Wisconsin in the first place, cut the check, but don't show up to campaign. Exactly. He's not going to go away. There's not going to be a you're fired moment a la The Apprentice here because Trump needs the money and he needs the federal government. But I do think this is going to be a slow fade.
That is Jonathan Martin. He's a senior political columnist at Politico. Jonathan Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
There will be a lot of security in San Antonio this weekend for the NCAA Men's Final Four. Safety is especially top of mind after the New Year's truck attack in New Orleans during the college football playoff. 14 people were killed and dozens were injured. Brian Kirkpatrick of Texas Public Radio reports that local law enforcement have been adjusting their plans to keep fans safe.
San Antonio is no stranger to March Madness or the tens of thousands of people who travel to be part of it. Home to the Alamo and the city's famed Riverwalk, police say they're ready to welcome more than 100,000 people to the Alamo Dome for games on Saturday and Monday. Dave Christensen traveled to San Antonio from Minneapolis. He says he has seen lots of security measures.
Just the security in general, I feel completely safe walking anywhere at night or during the day.
Christensen is rooting for Auburn. Duke, Florida, and Houston are also participating. San Antonio Police Chief William McManus says the city is ready to safely host the games.
In light of the tragic events that have occurred around the country recently, public safety is probably first and foremost on a lot of people's minds.
McManus would not reveal the exact number of officers on duty at venues across the city, but says it's all hands on deck, and barriers are in place to protect crowds from vehicles.
We have incorporated in our plans to prevent vehicular intrusion into the event areas.
There will be no public parking in downtown San Antonio during the games. McManus says all bags and backpacks must be see-through at all events, including the fan and music festivals. The open and concealed carrying of firearms will be prohibited, and mass evacuation plans are on standby. The spectacle of major sporting events like this one have often transcended national emergencies and anxieties. The hope here is this moment will be remembered for the basketball. I'm Brian Kirkpatrick in San Antonio.
This is NPR News.
On President Trump's second day in office, Mari Stonick was told the government is shuttering all DEI offices and you're being put on leave.
I was incredibly shocked, and the first thing I said was, I'm not in a diversity, equity, and inclusion role.
Now Stonick and others are fighting back. I'm Ari Shapiro. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump's sweeping tariffs announced yesterday are sparking a sell-off on Wall Street. The Dow is down nearly 1,500 points, or more than 3% this morning. The Nasdaq is down more than 4.5%. Investors are concerned about a broadening trade war as countries including China and ones in Europe pledge to retaliate. Trump is slapping 10% tariffs on nearly all U.S. imports. The exceptions include semiconductors, pharmaceuticals, and lumber. The president is also implementing reciprocal tariffs on 60 countries and territories, saying he wants to incentivize more companies to do business in the U.S., resulting in more manufacturing jobs domestically. Economists warn the tariffs will raise prices for American consumers. Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin says Trump is enacting the tariffs for the right reasons.
We have not been engaged in fair trade. We haven't been treated fairly by many of our trading partners. And this is trying to level the playing field in a very complex environment.
He was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. One of the big Detroit automakers, Stellantis, says it plans to temporarily lay off 900 workers at several plants in the U.S. in response to the president's tariffs. It will also temporarily halt production at plants in Mexico and Canada. This is NPR News. Flood watches extend from northeast Texas to northern Ohio. The National Weather Service is warning of potentially catastrophic flooding over the next few days because of stormy weather. The severe weather has spawned tornadoes in several states, leaving at least two people dead in Tennessee and another in Missouri. Structural damage and power outages are also reported. Nominations for this year's Lucille Lortel Awards are out. As Jeff London reports from New York, the honors recognize outstanding achievements in off-Broadway theater.
Drag, the musical, picked up six nominations, including Outstanding New Musical. Another musical, Three Houses, received six nominations, as did Our Class, a play set in 1941 Poland, which follows Jewish and Catholic classmates and the tragedy that befalls them. Some well-known actors were nominated, among them Adam Driver, who played a troubled country singer in Hold On to Me, Darling, and Andrew Scott, who's doing a one-person adaptation of Chekhov called Vanya. The Lortel Awards will be handed out on Sunday, May 4th. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Again on Wall Street, stocks are sharply lower this morning. The Dow is down 1,460 points, or more than 3%. I'm Dave Mattingly.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. The owners of TikTok have until Saturday to sell the app.
Earlier this year, lawmakers passed a law banning the app, citing national security concerns, unless it sheds its China-based owner, ByteDance. Following his inauguration, President Trump said he would not enforce the ban, which was still the law, and that he'd hold a public auction to sell TikTok over the coming months. Many bidders have lined up, including one from a YouTuber known as Mr. Beast, and a separate offer from Amazon.
But leading the pack is software company Oracle, according to NPR's Bobby Allen, who joins me now. Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning.
So why is Oracle's offer the Trump administration's preferred plan?
Yeah, for several reasons. First, Oracle already operates almost all of TikTok's cloud, so Oracle systems are, you know, already supporting the app. Secondly, Oracle has experience with high-level national security data. For instance, Oracle does cloud computer work for parts of the government, including the CIA. And finally, Oracle is run by billionaire Trump supporter Larry Ellison, and he has been setting the stage, Layla, for this deal for years by warming up to Trump, by defending Trump. Ellison even hammered out this deal that we're talking about right now, which involves leasing TikTok's algorithm from its current owner, the Chinese company ByteDance.
Leasing an algorithm, is that even a thing?
No, it's not really a thing, to be honest. It's extremely unusual, but a source close to the negotiations explained the logic behind it this way. A new US entity would be created, led by Oracle, that can oversee TikTok. Okay, and this new entity would lease TikTok's algorithm from ByteDance that would get around having to have the Chinese government sign off on the selling of the algorithm, which has always been an open question as to whether Beijing would approve that or not.
But I don't understand that, because I thought the whole idea of the TikTok ban was to split TikTok from China. Would this plan do that?
It depends on how you see that, right? It's been a very divisive thing in the White House, which is full of China hawks. And this is the big question, whether leasing the TikTok algorithm would mean China does not control it. This gets to why Congress passed a law forcing TikTok and China to break up in the first place, as you've mentioned. And lawmakers of both parties remain concerned that China will use TikTok to influence Americans to steal their data. Trump is hoping this deal, though, will put those fears to rest, but there is no guarantee.
Okay, so is there a timeline when this all might happen?
Yeah, Trump has set this Saturday as the deadline for when TikTok needs to be sold. Most are expecting a deal to be announced sometime before then. The question becomes, how is China going to respond? Under the Oracle deal under consideration in the White House, they're making a concession to ByteDance by allowing ByteDance to keep a minority stake in the company. It's worth noting that, you know, Trump's stiff tariffs on Chinese imports are part of the TikTok conversation. Chinese authorities, I think, were hoping TikTok could be used as leverage to get a better deal on tariffs, meaning, you know, if China supported a TikTok deal, maybe they would get some relief on tariffs. But it doesn't quite look like that is what happened.
And so you're telling me that Mr. Beast doesn't have a chance?
No, Mr. Beast doesn't have a chance. It's really sad, I know.
Mr. Beast. All right, thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Leila.
Myanmar's state-run media has announced a temporary ceasefire effective immediately in the country's civil war with groups opposed to the military running the government. The military junta had initially rejected calls for a ceasefire, but is now agreeing to stop fighting, it says, to help the relief effort following last Friday's 7.7 magnitude earthquake. More than 3,000 died in the quake, according to Myanmar's government, but that number is expected to grow. Reporter Michael Sullivan has been keeping up with this from neighboring Thailand. He's with us now. Hello again, Michael.
Hi, Michelle.
So that's quite a turnaround for the military, isn't it?
Yeah, big turnaround. I mean, just hours after the quake struck, the military conducted airstrikes against opposition targets in both Karen and Shan states in the east of the country, and on Tuesday, an airstrike in Kachin state in the north killed 38 people, according to the main rebel group there. Now, it's easy to see all of these attacks as incredibly cruel and cynical, but there's also another explanation, according to the International Crisis Group's senior Myanmar advisor, Richard Horsey, and that's that the military is scared.
They are terrified that they will lose even more if they give an inch to their opponents, who are beating them on the battlefield.
Now, the change of heart came after several major opposition groups announced their own ceasefire, so that may have been a factor. And the military may also have been influenced by international pressure, maybe even from their patron, China. But there could also be another quake-related reason. Here's Richard Horsey again.
It will be seen not only as some sort of karmic message, but also the devastation has been wrought on their core centers of power. You know, the capital, the second biggest city, which is the center of Buddhism in Myanmar, the monasteries lie in ruins. It's their power base that's been disproportionately hit by this. If they mess this up, the impact will be felt by their inner circle.
So some of the leadership's calculation might simply be about regime survival.
But could a week-long ceasefire mean that those who need help will actually get it?
We don't know, because stopping airstrikes is one thing, right? Allowing unfettered access for aid is another. The military's checkpoints and restrictions on cell and internet service were extremely tight even before the quake and remain so. And a Chinese relief team traveling by road from the border was shot at by the military in Shan State on Tuesday. No one was hurt, but still, I mean, the military has really messed with aid distribution since the coup. Here's Melissa Hine of the World Food Program in Yangon.
The operating environment is complex. That has been the case for the past 4 years, responding to people displaced by conflict. So I expect those challenges will continue.
She and others say there's an urgent need for shelter, food, and clean water, and for money for international donations to distribute it. There's a lot of it that's already been stockpiled in warehouses in Myanmar, but it takes trucks and gas and money to deliver it, yeah?
Yeah. So let me go back to this idea of the military trying to hang on. In the past year and a half, the opposition has been hammering the junta on the battlefield, and there were questions about whether it could survive. So what's the assessment of that now?
Well, oddly, this might actually help the regime hang on longer. Senior General Min Aung Hlaing agreeing to a ceasefire and international aid may actually raise his credibility in an international community that's shunned him and sanctioned Myanmar since the coup. Again, here's the International Crisis Group's Richard Horsey.
The regime still has some battlefield breathing space, but not a lot. It losing in the north to the Kachin, it's spectacularly losing in the west to the Arakan army. So this is a moment of jeopardy. It's a moment of great uncertainty, but it isn't a moment, I think, where we could have any confidence in saying the regime is about to fall.
That's been predicted many times before, and it hasn't happened yet.
That's Michael Sullivan in Thailand. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Scientists are racing to rebuild digital tools removed from federal websites by the Trump administration that access things like air and water pollution data. That's next time, here and now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. Hatta Rimer got a birthday card in the mail this week, one she's seen more than 80 times before. Rimer met Mary Wheaton when they were teens in Indianapolis. Wheaton gave her a birthday card for her 14th birthday, and it's been bouncing between them ever since. The inside is covered with their signatures over the decades. Rimer just turned 95 and will be putting the card back in the mail next month. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. There's a question on many scientists' minds as climate change heats up the planet.
Basically, how hot is too hot for humans to survive for long periods?
That's Harvard scientist Rob Mead, and his new study is getting scientists closer to an answer. Alejandra Barunda with NPR's Climate Desk reports.
Rob Mead looks at how human bodies handle heat. But in his new study, Mead wasn't just a researcher. He was a guinea pig. He put himself and 11 other volunteers into a heat chamber.
We exposed them to 107 Fahrenheit, so 42 degrees Celsius.
So, you know, hot.
We let them equilibrate for an hour, and then we slowly crank the humidity up.
Then he and other researchers watched what happened to people's core body temperatures. They would heat up pretty steadily, and then they would cross a threshold.
I've been referring to them as a "you're screwed" limit.
Beyond that threshold, their core temperatures skyrocketed. Left unchecked, their bodies would have succumbed to heat stroke and eventual death, but the researchers pulled them out of the heat chamber right after they passed that threshold. Mead lasted 6 hours in the heat chamber.
Your body's screaming at you, "Let's get out of the heat, let's get out of the heat."
But millions of people around the world can't get out of the heat, especially as climate change makes it more intense. And that growing threat opened a scientific question. Are there places on Earth that might become too hot to live? Scientists assumed there was a physical threshold beyond which people couldn't survive for more than a few hours, and for years, they thought it was 35 degrees Celsius, measured on a scale called the wet bulb temperature. That's equivalent to 95 degrees Fahrenheit at 100% humidity. But this new study and a few others suggest that
the limits to survivability or these critical environmental limits to compensability are lower than we thought.
That's Jenny Vinos. She's a heat expert at Arizona State University who did a similar analysis last year. And Vinos says scientists also know that people die from heat well below these extreme limits because heat puts so much stress on people's bodies. For example, the participants in Mead's study,
their body temperature was elevated by a degree to a degree and a half. Their hearts were beating 40 beats a minute faster than normal.
Stress like that can trigger issues like heart attacks and strokes. There are places in the world where people already deal with heat at that limit. King's College London climate scientist Tom Matthews mapped those places out a few years ago.
We found that wet bulb temperatures of 35 degrees had already been reached around Persian Gulf in the Indus Valley.
And further climate change will push more places toward those heat limits, especially if the limits are actually lower than 35 C on the wet bulb temperature. But Matthew says the next step is to really understand how people who already live in those places are surviving the most extreme extremes. Because
we're not simply products of the, or not totally at the mercy of the temperature and humidity that's outside.
People find ways to survive that super intense heat. And learning how they do so could help millions of others. Alejandra Barunda, NPR News.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, President Trump's insistence on making Greenland a U.S. territory is causing consumers in Denmark, which oversees the island, to turn their backs on American goods. Listen on your radio, the NPR app, or ask your smart speaker for your local station by name. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
34%, 32%, 24%, 20%. Those are the extra tariff rates on in order China, Taiwan, Japan, and Europe imposed by President Trump. Stock markets are down hard.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Baird. Baird strives to attract and retain top financial talent, providing stability and continuity for clients. More at BairdDifference.com.
Given tariffs, market players are saying were higher than many expected, I see the Dow is now down 1,533 points, 3.6%. The S&P down 4.3%. The Nasdaq really down 5.7%. Wall Street's fear gauge, the VIX index of stock market volatility, is up 26% right now. The bond market is up sharply with the higher risk of recession now, pulling 10-year interest rate down to 4.01%. Watch for it to go lower than 4%. Sometime today, possibly. Some see this as the moment that globalization ended. Marketplaces, well, in fact, President Trump sees it this way as he unveiled what he sees as reciprocal tariffs, customized for countries all around the world.
It's our declaration of economic independence. For years, hardworking American citizens were forced to sit on the sidelines as other nations got rich and powerful, much of it at our expense. But now it's our turn to prosper.
Traditionally close ally Britain gets a 10% tax on exports to the U.S., the EU 20%. Ursula von der Leyen is head of the European Commission.
The global economy will massively suffer. Uncertainty will spiral and trigger the rise of further protectionism. The consequences will be dire for millions of people around the globe.
Marketplace's Nova Safo is here with me with more.
Yeah, here's some other trading partners and what they're facing. Vietnam, think clothing and shoes, 46%. Import taxes on Chinese goods rise to about 54%. Markets are reacting. To get a sense of the mood, we spoke with Jeremy Swan. He's with the financial advisory firm Cohn Resnick.
The tariffs that were announced were much more substantial than people expected. When you look at, you know, the U.S. and you look at the global markets right now, the expectation is that this is, you know, it's going to have a significant inflationary impact within the U.S.
Now, Swan's hoping some of the bigger tariffs can be negotiated down, but worries that the 10% across-the-board tariff is here to stay. And there are fears of a trade war igniting as well because countries are preparing retaliatory tariffs, David.
No, Nova, most economists tell us that tariffs lead to higher prices here, which consumers pay. What are you seeing?
Yeah, well, we put that question to the Yale Budget Lab. It's been calculating the potential impacts of the various Trump administration tariffs. And to add it all up, here's the Budget Lab's Director of Economics, Ernie Tedeschi.
So everything that's been announced so far would come to about $3,800 per household per year, roughly a $3.1 trillion tax increase over 10 years. And that means an increase in prices of 2.3% over the next year.
And Tedeschi also says expect U.S. economic growth to slow as well, David.
Thanks. Now to China, which has vowed countermeasures. Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pack spoke to a factory owner who makes shoes mostly sold to the U.S.
China ShoeBot manufactures athletic shoes for small and medium brands. Over half of its clientele is American. The firm's CEO is James Gao. Short term, he says, the latest tariffs might be positive for China's shoe manufacturing because for the past few years, big shoe brands have been shifting production to Southeast Asia. He says now that tariffs on countries like Vietnam, Cambodia, and Indonesia are 30% to over 40%, it might not be that much cheaper for companies to shift away from China because industry experts say China is still the most efficient place to manufacture shoes and at a higher quality. As for the future, says Gao, the American government is highly volatile, he says. After speaking to his U.S. clients, they've agreed to wait for a month and see how things go. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
With some financial firms like Barclays now seeing a, quote, high risk of a U.S. recession this year, the price of crude oil is down nearly 8%. It's the biggest drop in 5 years for Apple stock now, down 9%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
And by Sold a Story, investigating how the education system got reading wrong and takes you places getting it right. Sold a Story, available in podcast apps.
Amid recession talk, we note the U.S. labor market had been running strong, and a report from the Dallas Fed says it is sectors like healthcare driving this. Here's Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall.
Among labor economists and monetary policy wonks, Luke Pardue with the Aspen Economic Strategy Group says there's still an open question.
Why do we still continue to see that really strong jobs growth relative to pre-pandemic levels when the Federal Reserve just went through this whole tightening cycle?
The Dallas Fed report had an answer. Job growth has happened in sectors that are less cyclical.
Sectors like healthcare or the federal or state governments aren't as sensitive to interest rates because they don't need to rely on investment or sort of credit. In this post-pandemic time, a lot of the employment growth is coming from areas that just aren't as responsive to interest rates.
But there are other theories about labor market resilience. Economist Vivi Chari is with the University of Minnesota.
What looks like strength is just the normal process of recovery from the very sharp decline in employment that occurred during COVID period.
But he suspects there's also something else at play.
Certainly, strong employment growth is probably due to the unprecedented surge in immigration.
The conference board's Mitchell Barnes agrees.
Immigration is a key piece to this puzzle. When you really just look at the population growth that we've seen, that is not only adding to the worker pool, but that's adding to households, adding to spending.
Immigrants increase the demand for products and services. Barnes says public investments during the Biden administration also supported the labor market.
You know, I think there are some one-offs where you start to look at some of the policy impacts that are underlying these numbers. Non-residential construction, you know, potentially a beneficiary of a lot of that federal investment, has been, pretty strong over that same time.
He says for each sector, there are different reasons for resilience. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Checking the Dow again, down 1,557 points. Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.